passion and pageantry of college football lives here. This is the Paul Feinbaum Show, Hour 3 Podcast.
This might be college football heaven.
Welcome back as we continue here. Throughout this season, Jimbo Fisher's name has popped up, but most people were under the assumption that the buyout would be too much if the season went south. There's only one person who kept saying on national television, the Big Noon Kickoff, that Jimbo Fisher was in trouble. That one person was Bruce Feldman, who joins us now from The Athletic and Fox. So, Bruce, thank you. Appreciate the time. And take us through your reporting and information throughout the year on why you kept hearing things were pointing against Jimbo Fisher.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, it really had been simple as this. Yes, the money was insane. The buyout was enormous, unprecedented. But it was also year six, and what I had been hearing from sources was, what is Jimbo going to do now that'll convince anyone at this point that he can lead them to a national title? What's another 8-4 going to prove? And when they lost to Miami, and again, this is not Jimmy Johnson's Miami or Ed Reed Miami. This is a rebuild of a team that wasn't very good. And not only did they lose, they got smacked by Miami pretty bad. And from that point, it was panic from what I'm told in a lot of the money people around the Texas A&M, big money, the guys. And when they looked at all this and you looked at what they had coming up, it was like, okay, are they going to turn around and run the table? Because everything I had heard was that if he's not like 9-3 or better, they're done with him. And that was a bad sign to lose to Miami the way they did. The other thing that I'm told heard a lot was that Steve Sarkisian comes in there half the time that Jimbo's been on the job. And he goes into Tuscaloosa and they take it to Alabama and beat them. And they're looking like a team that's going to go to the playoff. And A&M didn't even go to a bowl game last year. I mean, Jimbo Fisher had what a lot of recruiting observers said was the highest ranked recruiting class in the country. They haven't won a road game in over 2 years now. So the idea that Texas A&M was going to sit back and keep giving Jimbo Fisher more money and just riding this out because they're stuck behind a big buyout when they could do something about it, what I was told is they could not afford to keep him on there any longer.
Incredible stuff, Bruce. So tell us, I know you've put some stories out there about possibilities. It encompasses a lot of names, but in terms of real legitimate candidates, what are you hearing?
I think right now it's a tricky spot for A&M. When Jimbo got the job, he had won a national title at Florida State. The program had already started to backslide, but he still was a guy who'd been in the SEC and won a national title. I don't think there's that big shiny object out there for them. It's much different right now. Now, they have Lance Leipold, who has no connections to the SEC, he's from Wisconsin, won a bunch of Division III national titles, and has done an amazing job at Kansas. You know, he's a legitimate candidate if he's interested in Michigan State's vacancy. I don't know, you know, I wouldn't doubt him. I think he's one of the 10 best coaches in the country, but is he going to be the guy that you feel like is going to go in and be able to compete with Kirby Smart and Nick Saban? I don't know. Mike Elko is another name that I think will get traction. He was on Jimbo's staff when they had a really good defense. He's since gone off to Duke, had a terrific first year there, started out the year beating Clemson handily. People really respect him. He's a really sharp guy. And I think what would help in this case is there is a lot of talent on the roster there. If you bring in a Mike Elko, do you have a chance to retain a lot of that? I mean, it's hard to find really good defensive minds, and he's one of them. And he clearly knew what he was doing when he took over at Duke. So, again, he's a guy that I think, you know, Michigan State also very interested in. But ultimately, you know, Texas A&M has a lot more resources. I mean, and once you get past that, I feel like there's a lot of, like, fingers crossed on, well, maybe Kalen DeBoer at Washington or Dan Lanning, who's done great at Oregon, has a big buyout too, by the way. But is, you know, has some SEC ties, having worked in Tuscaloosa and Athens. I don't like when I look at this search, it's like, I'm not saying they won't get a really good coach who has a chance to make them into a playoff team, but there's not going to be that guy, I don't think, who's going to be the big splashy hire that you know, Scott Woodward had and they gave all this money to and then, you know, turned out to be a dud.
Talking to Bruce Feldman, Bruce, earlier today, the X came for Zach Arnett, not a shock. In terms of what Zach Selman is trying to figure out and looking toward, what are you hearing?
In some ways, Paul, I think this is, I don't want to say it's an easier search, but I think because the bar, you know, fair or unfair, is just lower. You know, if you have a guy who goes 8-4 at Mississippi State, they're going to probably build him statues. If you have him in College Station, they're going to run him out as soon as they can afford to run him out. You know, the people I talked to this morning made a good point, and one of them that spent a lot of time, you know, working at Mississippi State and said, you have to be different there if you want to have a real chance to sustain something. That's why I think a guy like Jamie Chadwell won a lot of games at Coastal Carolina, very creative offense. Now he's at Liberty. He's undefeated there. I think he's a guy that they will certainly look at. I think there's a handful of other names who are, you know, John Sumrall, done an amazing job at Troy in 2 years, former Kentucky assistant, really well-regarded inside coaching, got a lot of presence to him. I think he's going to be a big-time SEC head coach before too long. I think he makes a lot of sense. You have Willie Fritz at Tulane. I mean, they won 12 games last year and beat USC in the bowl game, and, you know, they're a top 25 team again. It's really hard to do what he's done at that school, and I think he would make some sense. They have, I think, good options here. It's just a matter of how, you know, which direction. This is Zach Selman's first big hire. You know, we know he's, you know, came from Oklahoma, he's been groomed well for this situation. He wants his own guy. I'm curious to see the direction he goes.
Bruce, there are a lot of possibilities out there, and this is a slow developing season, other than Northwestern before the season and Michigan State. But what else are you hearing in relation to coaches in serious trouble?
You know, there's a few situations actually in the Southwest that I think you got to keep an eye on. Dana Holgorsen has a big buyout at Houston, but they've had a couple of really bad losses, including losing to a really bad Cincinnati team this past weekend. We know from past experience that is a very volatile place in terms of the leadership. They didn't, you know, they ran Tony Levine out after he, you know, didn't take him long to get things going, and then they ran him out of there. They gave Major Applewhite 2 years and ran him out. I don't know if they'll, you know, if Dana loses one or two of the next two games and they're winnable games, wouldn't shock me if they made a change there. It also, you know, Baylor is a situation. Dave Aranda had a terrific year a couple of years ago, and I know the administration there really likes him, but the talent level seems to have dropped off dramatically since it's no longer Matt Rhule's guys are in there. You know, if you asked me 3 weeks ago, I think he was going to be okay, and they'd probably have to make offensive staff changes again. Now, I don't know. I think the pressure's ratcheted up there. I think there's some pressure, you know, still there in Arkansas with Sam Pittman. You know, I thought Sam Pittman's, you know, did a pretty good job for a while. They're better than most of us expected. But now, you know, he hired Daninos to run the offense. That didn't work out. And I think they know that that's only going to get harder in that league with Texas and OU coming in if you're Arkansas. So there's a lot to sort out there, you know, for the Razorbacks as well in the last couple of weeks.
I read something in L.A. today. I think it was Bill Plaschke said there's no way UCLA can go into the Big Ten with Chip Kelly. I mean, that surprises me how that team has fallen off the cliff too.
Yeah, the offense has really been just such a mediocre group right now. You know, they're playing their third string quarterback. They look like they lost to a really bad Arizona State team the other night with a bad offensive performance. The defense is actually much better than it's been under Danton Lynn. It's the offense, which has been Chip Kelly's thing, that has just been really, really underwhelming. you know, and they're sitting here now at 6-4. They play USC, who's also reeling. I think if they beat UCLA, I think people will around UCLA will be fine. But you know, there's so much apathy to begin with when it comes to UCLA football. And I think they're kind of looking at it going, hey, I thought we were going to take a step forward. Instead, it feels like we've taken a step back. And they're sitting there watching Oregon and Washington with two, you know, second year coaches who've come in and lit it up on the West Coast. And you have UCLA that quite honestly just feels like it's kind of stuck in gear. They have two more games. If he goes 8-4, I think everything will be fine. If he loses the next game and finishes 6-6, he doesn't have a huge buyout. I don't, you know, that would definitely be one to watch just because last week's performance against ASU, I think, was one that left a lot of UCLA fans, at least the ones who were engaged, really, really disappointed.
Bruce, what's the conversation about coaching searches without bringing Deion Sanders in? As I'm sure you know by now, your good friend, well, my good friend, I should say, Stephen A. Smith, you know, flat out said he has to be the next coach at Texas A&M. Not to get you into ESPN food fights, but what is the situation with Deion after a disastrous finish here in November?
You know, my gut is Deion has a lot of these pieces back or next year, including his son, Travis Hunter. You know, he probably can't transfer again because, you know, he's too young to make that big move. I think next year, if Deion really upgrades, especially the big people on both sides of the ball, I think they can go into the Big 12 and make a lot of noise. The idea that Deion would bounce, I don't know how great of a fit Texas A&M would be for him. On one sense, I think it would – Texas A&M doesn't have great alignment right now. You got a bunch of presidents come through there in and out. The thing that Deion got at Colorado was he got a leadership group starting with Rick George, AD, to buy in and go all in on all things Deion. And they got out to a fast start. I think the place that would probably be more, you know, possible if it played this way, and I just don't think the timing lines up, but it's one that I'm like, I could kind of see this, is more Arkansas. Because I know when Deion went through the interview process, I think they were impressed on both sides of it. And now he's more proven because he took over a one-win team, and whether they've stalled out, you know, since mid-season, they're so much better than they were before he took over. You know, Arkansas is not far from his, you know, power base, you know, that he has in the state of Texas. To me, they're probably Arkansas would make more sense than an A&M where you just wonder about the alignment, you wonder about the fit. And if I'm Deion, I'm thinking maybe, you know, I have another year here, write out the guys I have, really upgrade the rest of the roster, and then I see where I'm at, as opposed to jumping into what feels like a, I don't want to say an unstable situation, but again, the alignment is something that I would be very concerned about.
Bruce, I know I've gone long, but one more question, because you were so embedded and immersed in the story Friday and, of course, Saturday morning, and that's where are we with Harbaugh right now and just your reaction to just everything that
you
said.
Yeah, Paul, it's such a soap opera right now. I think I can't remember a situation where you had one conference as at odds with a flagship school the way new commissioner Tony Petitti and the Big Ten are against Michigan. And it feels almost like a pro wrestling kind of script that's playing out. And, you know, watching that game, you know, to see, you know, this happens a lot, right? Where teams say it's us against the world. Remember when Ryan Day went off on Lou Holtz after they beat Notre Dame, it was like Ohio versus everybody. Well, right now it definitely being at that game and on the field in Penn State, it's definitely felt like Michigan versus everybody. And that included at times, it felt like almost like Michigan versus the refs. It felt like Michigan versus Penn State. It's absolutely going to feel like Michigan versus Ohio State. You know, it's nasty right now. And so he's going to be in person on Friday for this hearing. We'll see how it plays out. I don't think, you know, it's wildly unpredictable right now. I can't wait to see the next step in this saga though.
Fantastic conversation with Bruce Feldman of The Athletic and Fox. We will take a very short break here. Been a pretty crazy show. We started with Brian Kelly a couple of hours ago. We'll head to Tuscaloosa a little bit later on.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
We are back. Fantastic conversation there with Bruce. It's hard to find anybody that has a better understanding of the way college searches work than him. Let's continue with more phone calls. And Adina is up next. Good afternoon.
Hey, Paul. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
My point, really my question, I've seen Alabama backdoor many years to get into the playoffs. Not every time, but there was one year before the four playoff system where Oregon had to lose and a whole lot of things had to happen.
Sure.
But one by one, they happened. So my question is, if Texas continues to win, and Alabama should beat Georgia, which I want a shot at Michael Bratton when that happens. But is there any possible way, if the planets aligned, that they would pick Alabama over Texas?
Yeah, let me try to break this down how it could go. Let's go ahead and say Michigan wins out and goes to the Final Four. That's one. Then you have the winner of the Pac-12, if it is Washington. They would be undefeated, so I think they would get in there. Then you get the Texas-Florida State SEC card. And I think the Texas comparison is fascinating. I'm also starting to wonder about the Florida State card. Because that win over LSU was ballyhooed, and the win over Clemson in overtime. But I think if Texas were to win out and get there, then I think that helps Alabama a little bit. And maybe the better comparison is with Florida State. I mean, do I think Alabama is a better team than Florida State? Yeah, I think they'd beat them by two touchdowns. Do I think Alabama would beat Texas again? Yes, I do. I think Alabama is that good right now. So I'm hoping that this committee will be objective because I think if Alabama beats Georgia, I mean, there's not a win in the country that really, I mean, maybe Ohio State winning against Michigan at Michigan, but that would be automatic anyway. I mean, I think there are a couple of variables. It would help if Washington State lost this weekend to Oregon State. It would help if there are a couple of crazy things that happen. But I think Alabama, assuming it beats Georgia, really ought to and will be in the college football playoff. Thank you very much. Susie is in Georgia. Hey, Susie.
Good afternoon, Paul.
Thank you.
Good to hear your voice. I wanted to tell you that Friday's SEC Nation was one of the best afternoons I have spent watching you. You and Laura just, I smile the whole time. They better not ever separate you two because you two just play off each other so well. She's just so bubbly and personable. And your story about your hotel room.
That was funny.
Ending up in the kitchen. I was almost crying. I was laughing so hard. I was visualizing you all getting off the elevator and finding yourself in the kitchen. And then you pass Ryan in the hallways. It was like Three Stooges.
You know, Susie, I know there's a lot of fake television where everything is pre-programmed, but the reality is that we are usually on the plane together. We ride to the hotel, and then I don't really see her again until the show. So we're not plotting it out. And I think that's what makes it so interesting. It's organic. And I don't ever really know what we're going to talk about. That goes for the Saturday
and
show, too.
That's the joy of it. That's what's so great about it, because it's spontaneous.
Well, she has this personality, which you know you're well aware of, that just makes it easy. And the only thing I could tell you is I do forget that there is a television camera and an audience. So it's like we are sitting there and just trying to entertain and have fun at a like in the kitchen at a party, which we have done before.
Yeah.
And I think some, there was a moment, I'll go back, I don't know, maybe 6 years. We happened to, I remember exactly where we were. Greg Byrne, the athletic director at Alabama, invited everyone over to his house the night before the game. And Laura and I were in the kitchen, and you know, there were 8 or 9 or 10 people, and we started telling some stories just like we do on the show. And the next thing you know, I later told her, I said, I think we could go on the road for a comedy tour based on what I just heard from you that day. And we never did. Somebody came up with, somebody actually brought it up. An agent at one of the big agencies in California called me once about going out. And I did not like the setup. I didn't like what they were charging. Although I do have some regrets. I think Laura and I would be in Hollywood right now. We'll take a short break. Stephen M. Smith, the most knowledgeable Stephen Smith on television today, will join us next.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
We are 2 weeks away from the, well, the hype's already began, but we're 2 weeks away from the official week of Alabama, Georgia. So we thought we would check in with Stephen M. Smith. It's been too long, Stephen. You told us Jalen Milroe had a chance to be a great quarterback, and man, you were right. Good afternoon.
How we doing, Paul? How we feeling this time?
We're doing great. What's happening?
Doing good, man. I mean, it's crazy how the season versus the offseason, right? The offseason, nobody really truly knows. And then the season kind of shows us, hey, maybe if we take a bit more time, we can actually see what happens.
So how do you explain what we have seen here in spite of that bump in the road, which to me, I know everyone wants to blame the critics, but it seemed like it was self-inflicted.
I mean, it was, and it was a product of this team not necessarily gelling the way it needed to. I know a lot of people looked at, well, why can't we see more Tommy Reese offensively early? You know, why is the defense not just taking off quickly under Kevin Steele? But you know, the best things, they take time. And Saban had to grow with this team. This is a young bunch. You don't have a Bryce Young. You don't have a Will Anderson. You don't have a lot of those older guys that sort of been there, done that. So Saban has mentioned, yes, this team has taken some years off of his life, but he loved that challenge. He loves to teach. And I think the teaching version of Nick Saban has been more so suited for this team because it's helped this team grow.
Stephen M., now that Alabama's really, you know, has Auburn left and obviously Georgia, let me just talk about, or let you talk about, I should say, where this team is, because it could very well upset Georgia, slight upset, and then start to be compared and contrasted with a couple of other teams, including one it lost to for the CFP.
This team is in a very, Paul, it's in a very unique situation because I kind of compare this team to the 2015 Alabama team in a sense of that 2015 Bama team, no one knew about that team either. That team came in, you really didn't know what Jacob Coker was until he finally started to showcase his talent. I mean, you knew what you had in Derrick Henry, but after him, you didn't know what you had at running back. Defensively, you had some talent, but you didn't quite know who the baton would fall on to be the leader until Reggie Ragland stepped up. And then that team took a week 3 loss to Ole Miss and Brian Denny, 43-37. And that team was written off, but it slowly found itself and it came on to win a national championship. So this team is primarily in the exact same format as that 2015 team. You look at Jalen Milroe's growth, Tommy Reese's growth, the defense coming together, and even Nick Saban. I mean, there was a few years where he wasn't even yelling at people anymore, wasn't even challenging people, wasn't even really going at people. And it took Miss Terry to say, baby, break a headset, pop a blood vessel, do something. Get yourself ignited with passion inside of you. So this team has had to follow the same kind of format as the 2015 team followed, and it finds itself in a place where it can win an SEC championship and compete for the college football playoff, though it does need help from some other teams to lose.
Let me go back to what you just said there, because I mean, the idea that Miss Terry is the MVP is just, it's just fascinating. So tell us what you know about that in terms of not so much what happened, but why do you think Nick Saban was on the course that he was until he was prompted to change?
I think he was on the course because he looks at this generation athlete much different than years past. When Saban first got to Tuscaloosa in 07, you had the Julio Joneses, you had the Donta Hightowers, the Mark Barons, those guys that can take that hard coaching where you can cuss them out, you can say different things, you can get under their skin, because probably those guys grew up in a home environment where they could take a little cussing out, they could take a little verbal gnashing, if you will. But Saban has learned that, okay, this generation of athlete, I can't really say certain things, because if I say this, do I risk this guy hopping in the transfer portal? If I say that or do that, do I risk losing this guy out of the program? So he's had to kind of mellow it down a bit, but mellow it down a bit to where he sort of lost a bit of himself. And in the essence of Nick Saban is, I have to get rowdy sometimes. I have to chew somebody out sometimes. I have to get on guys, sometimes even coaches, because that's what keeps me in the element of my game and who I am as Nick Saban. And I think Miss Terry, out of anybody, peeped that out, because she's on him after games, coach him about, okay, you got to get on this guy, you got to get on that guy. But I think even Miss Terry figured out, okay, if my husband is to be the best that he needs to be, then I got to get on him. And I got to make sure, hey, it's okay to go off. It's okay to check players. It's okay to check coaches. Be mellow, but don't be this mellow to where we know it's not you.
So, I mean, should we be surprised, though, Stephen A., that Miss Terry is the MVP? I mean, Miss Terry is maybe saved this season, because, I mean, she's always been doing stuff like that, hasn't she?
She has been, Paul, but not to this extent. I mean, she's always been the MVP behind the scenes, but I think this is the first year where if you're Greg Byrne and you have to set up the Miss Terry Saban statue, like, this is the year to do it, right? Because she's been upfront now about not only reigniting Coach Saban, but also you have seen her after games hug players. Like after the A&M game, she's right there hugging Terrion Arnold. She's right there telling Terrion, good job by you, way to get in there. Where to get after, where to be involved. She's texting players, keeping players focused on the main things. She's up there in Bryant Denny yelling and screaming Dixieland Delight in the smoke fest that happened after the Tennessee game. So she's always been the MVP, but this is kind of the first season, Paul, that you see her front and center stage, not just giving Nick Saban the peck on the cheek after the game, but she's right there, center stage, encouraging these players. So I think if there was ever a moment where she's the concrete MVP, this would be the year.
So what, you're in Tuscaloosa, I haven't been there in a couple of weeks. What's the info, what's the intel on the Miss Terry statue?
The intel on that, Greg Byrne has not given me the ETA on that, on when it will be erected.
Come on, Stephen, so, you have to start making some noise. That's you can do that.
I will say this. I have put in some emails, so they've been getting to Greg Byrne. So more than likely, after the Iron Bowl, hopefully we can get that started.
Well, I'm going to be disappointed if our friend Stephen M. Smith doesn't make this happen, because the nation needs to see that statue.
The nation does, and quite typically I do myself, because she's been good to me personally. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been on an elevator in games and I see Miss Terry and she's walking over and she's giving me a hug and she's checking on how I'm doing. So not just the fan base and the program, but I myself definitely need to see this thing go
well, up. Hey, I can tell you, I was very close to Miss Terry when I lived in Alabama. I even was at the house one day. We were doing a TV show and I sat on her piano and she did not scream, although she was quite distressed. She took me down. I got to see the Saban suit collection. But I will also say this to you. You don't want to be at the other end when Miss Terry is upset that something you've said.
Yeah.
I've been there. It's not fun.
Not fun. Not fun. Actually, worse than coach. Not fun.
I can handle him. You're right. No, that's just standard operating procedure, him getting upset about something. But Miss Terry, man. I'll be there whatever day it is. I don't care what rain or shine. I'll be there. I'll buy a ticket to the unveiling of the statue and give you the lion's share of the credit.
Well, Paul, I appreciate that, but all I just want to see is this statue. Whether I get the credit or not, I just want the statue up.
It's happening. Thank you, Stephen M. Stephen M. Smith with the biggest scoop of the college football season. Miss Terry saved the Alabama season, and we will be right back.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
Welcome back. Final couple of moments of this third hour. I think that's right. Let's check out some callers here. How about Joe in Ohio? Hello, Joe.
Hey, Paul, you there?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon.
Hey, how you doing?
We're doing great. Thank you.
Hey, enjoy the show, man. Appreciate your analysis with all the sports all the time.
Thank you.
So I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but if I may.
Well, go ahead. We beat dead horses here every day.
Yeah. So I'm just confused, man. I feel like my intelligence had been insulted a little bit, and so I'm trying to find some validity to the Michigan thing. And this, what I'm about to say, has nothing to, you know, directed towards the state of Michigan, you know, the coaches, the players, you know, especially the student athletes. You know, there's nothing that they had to do with this stuff. But one of my biggest problems is I've watched for the past 2 weeks, right? And I've heard Dion talk about it. I've heard, you know, some of the other greats talk about it. And the one thing, like, I go back to what I was just saying about being confused, is I don't understand the quote, and kind of semi-quotes here, when a lot of them are saying, well, you still got to stop them. So there's really no advantage. So my question to those remarks, because I've heard them over and over by, you know, not all, but some of the analysts, like, I'm not a pro athlete, okay? So it could be hearsay from me. But if I know another team is running a draw, couldn't I stack the box and bring the linebackers down? You know what I'm saying? If I'm running a quick slant, bring the safeties in. If I'm running an out, you know what I'm saying? Like, is that not an advantage or not? I mean,
sure it is.
I know how to stop them, but the point is if they're running up the middle, you're going to bring the linebackers up.
It's also very unfair to your players. If the other team knows the plays, I really think you can cause a lot of harm and injuries.
No, it's a very valid point. Yeah, I agree with that totally. So anyway, I guess the last thing is probably kind of a short call, but so my next question is, you know, again, and I believe in due process too, so I don't believe all the hype, you know, let that play out and however long it takes. But if they find them guilty, whether it's this year or into the spring, I'm not familiar with NCAA rules, the commissions, or the Big Ten and what they can do, but I'm kind of saddened if they are actually found guilty, you go back 2 years, right? And if they can prove that, then what happens then? Like, is there
I think what happens, if they can, you know, first of all, it takes a long time to make an NCAA case, but if for some reason they expedite it, fast track it, I think there's a good chance Harbaugh could be done. But the problem is the NCAA will not react quickly. There's no way that their record. I mean, Jim Harbaugh is still being adjudicated by the NCAA for something he did during COVID. So it's a 3-year process, and I just don't think it's going to happen in time. Thank you very, very much for the call. Man is up next.
Well, good. I'm thankful I didn't have another question. I mean, you know, he calls your show. He has no idea what the NCAA is going to do and who's going to do this and who's going to do that. I mean, you're talking on the phone that's got more information than mankind has ever seen. You've got more information in your hand than it took for man to get to the moon. Is that a fair statement?
Of course it is. Yes.
Of course it is, technically. Yeah, I mean, I like the way you back down off of that, technically. You know, Paul, I love it when I hear the Bama fans calling in.
Oh, we're back to Bama again. Little Nicky.
They got the white knuckles. I mean, they're begging and they're pleading with you to give them some sense of hope. I mean, I don't know why you don't take Touchdown Jesus out of Notre Dame and put it in Tuscaloosa, because they just need you so bad.
They just went on the road and destroyed another opponent, man.
I mean, they're at wit's end. I mean, these people are fixing to go to the doctors and start taking a bunch of pills and drinking and driving and texting and socializing and jumping over seats on people that are drunk. And, I mean, you know, and hanging out in the New Orleans bars and crystals and stuff. This is a sick fan base, Paul. I mean, they are at their wit's end to the point that Larry has to put his beard down and talk to one of your guests because, what a crazy group. A crazy group of people just over so they can buy a damn $5 T-shirt for $45. They don't even realize the taxing that school up in North Alabama is doing to them. They have literally owned that fan base to the point that when Nick Saban's out there at the spring game, he makes them run 100 yards to get in line to get his autograph. I mean, what can you help? What can we do? What can happen?
What are you going to do here 2 weeks from today when Alabama – is in the playoffs?
It's not going to happen
3 weeks from now.
It's just not going to happen. There's too much entanglement in front of them. They beat themselves.
What are you
going to
do,
Paul,
when Nick Saban's holding up that trophy on January 8th?
It's not going to happen.
That's going to be a sad day for you.
That's for the what if Bammers. That ain't
after
for the
all
factor,
this hate
that ain't
you've been
factor,
spewing. You're going to have to grin and bear
this
it for
is
one
not
more
hate.
Year.
This is not hate. This is commentary. I'm talking about things on topic within the last 30 minutes. I mean, you had that one lady, Twyla, whatever her name was. I mean, what can we do, Paul? We need chaos. We need...
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.